I hope everyone's doing well today. It's April 1st, and I was thinking of starting these podcasts, maybe not all of them, but I'll test it out here. So I was thinking of starting these podcasts with just checking in with my emotional state in this exact moment. Because, in these intros, reading scripts and everything, it just feels maybe a little stiff. So I want to be a little bit more real and ground myself in authenticity, which is what this Stoa project is really aiming for. So let's see how it goes. So right now I am feeling just sort of like a calmness, but there's like a tension with that calmness too. There's like a subtle, what's the word for it? And there's like an annoyance quality with this calmness. It's this weird tension. But overall, I feel pretty decent. I feel pretty focused and plugged in this moment. All right, cool. So I'd also like to start these intros with mentioning upcoming events at the Stoa. And you can sign up to all these on the website, thestoa.ca. One we have tomorrow is on COVID-19. It's an article that Zach Stein wrote for Emerge, and it's titled "A War Broke Out in Heaven." And everyone's like raving about this article in the Sense Making Web. So he's going to have a brief discussion on that, or we're going to have a brief discussion on that, and then we're going to open up for Q&A. And that is tomorrow, April 2nd, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The other one I'd like to put on your radar is an existential dance party with Colin Morris. Whew, this one's going to be tomorrow as well at 7:30 p.m. And the first one we did was quite fun. It was like, I loved it actually. It was amazing. And I'm not someone who dances often. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And Colin's going to do that regularly at the Stoa at that time. And on the 3rd, the Friday, is it the Friday? I don't even know what day is it. Yeah, so it's a Friday. Richard Bartlett, who's previously on this podcast, he's doing a session with me called Alongsideness. And I really liked how he framed it. It's that, we're so fixated on our purpose, looking in front of us, that we forget to kind of look beside us and see who's alongside us. So that's on Friday, April 3rd at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's going to be an interesting, we're going to do some interesting conversational techniques and stuff, break out people in different rooms. So I'm looking forward for that. And also on Friday at 6:30 p.m., Patrick Ryan, I dub him the most dangerous man on the internet. He was previously on the podcast as well. And he's doing a COVID trolley, the trolley problem memes that you see about COVID. He's going to do a session on that, and we're going to open up for Q&A. So that should be really, really intriguing. And that's this Friday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Okay, so we're going to hear in a moment Robin Hanson, who's Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University, also a Research Associate at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. He writes this blog, Overcoming Bias, which I think, if I get my intellectual history right, kind of birthed the whole rationalist movement, because the Less Wrong blog emerged from Overcoming Bias. He's also the author of The Elephant in the Brain, which is a really, really good book. Robin came in on Monday to the Stoa, and the session was called Overcoming Bias During COVID-19, and he was talking about considering deliberate infection. And he has this like provocative idea that he presented on his blog, and he wanted to share it with the people at the Stoa. So we opened the space up for him, and some excellent Q&A happened after Robin gave his little talk and shared his thoughts. So after the little badass intro for the Stoa, you're going to hear just Robin jump in with his thoughts on considering deliberate infection.
Welcome to the Stoa. The Stoa is a digital campfire where we cohere and dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of what's happening now.
So as you know, there's this virus out there, expanding pandemic. And usually with the pandemic, you would try to catch it early. And you put a lot of work into catching it early with tracing and testing and isolating. And we screwed that up. We didn't catch this one early. And most health professionals would have said and did say, well, I guess it's going to go everywhere. So I guess we should just try to flatten the curve and deal with it as best we can because we let it go. And in the last few weeks, people have said, no, you can't do that. Millions of people will die, which they will. And people have been really excited to try to suppress, to lock down. And, you know, people said, stay home and don't go out and don't go to work. And many people have hope that that'll work. And there is hope, but we should have a plan B because we are really catching this late. And all these people who think, yeah, we can do this, they're the people who screwed up in the first place. So I'm not that hopeful, but of course we should try. But the question is, what if we can't suppress it? What if it is basically eventually going to get to most everyone? What do we do then? So the usual story is to flatten the curve then, i.e. to spread out who gets infected when so that we aren't all infected at the same time so that the medical system will be there for us more. So if we're all infected in the same 2 weeks, the entire world, then, you know, they just can't help us all. That's a bit of a problem from the point of view of death rates because, in fact, there's what's called a dose effect. That is, when you get sick with the virus, you don't just get sick or not, you get sick with a certain amount of the virus. And that initial size of the dose that you get sick with matters a lot. So as soon as you get sick with the virus, your body turns on and goes, oh, and it tries to grow a response as fast as it can. And the virus is trying to grow as fast as it can. And your body is in a contest growing. But the size of that initial amount affects how well it can win. So if it's a very tiny initial amount, your body can beat it out. But if it's a much larger amount, then it does worse. So there's a very consistent data in medicine that the initial dose of a virus matters for the severity of the symptoms and whether you die. And we have data on that for SARS, which came out, you know, in the last decade or two, showing, you know, people in the field when they were far away from a source versus close to a source. There was three times the death rate when they were closer to the source. There's data on measles in African villages where the first kid in a family to get it would have a 14 times lower death rate than the other kids in the family who would get it. And we have this thing called smallpox variolation. So back in the 1700s, before they had vaccines, what they did to treat smallpox around the world and in the West starting then was to give people a small amount of smallpox infection. And then instead of, say, a 20 to 30% death rate, typically for smallpox, it would be a 1 to 2% death rate for smallpox. And for example, at Valley Forge, George Washington inoculated his troops this way, and that put the death rate down to 2% instead of much higher, which saved Valley Forge. And had the troops, U.S. troops in Canada, done the same thing a few months earlier, they would have not died, and we would be part of, Canada would be part of the United States. That's the history of the U.S. Civil War. It's, the U.S. Revolutionary War. So that means, unfortunately, that if we lock everybody down and they catch the disease at home, they're going to catch a larger dose, which means they have a larger chance of dying. And that's a problem with lockdown. It doesn't mean it isn't worth it if you could actually suppress the whole thing and prevent lots more people from catching it. But if we're in the situation where most everybody will get it, then it's more of a trade-off regarding lockdown. But it raises this possibility, well, what if we could just deliberately infect people with small doses like they did with smallpox back in the 1700s for this disease? So that's not strange in theoretical. I mean, we know how to infect people with diseases. I mean, often, like, if you do an experiment for, say, flu and you want to get people infected with the flu, you just make them play a card game where they exchange the cards, and then they quickly all get infected by playing cards. So the idea here then would be to say, well, if most everyone's going to get it, why don't we try to intentionally get people to get it with a small dose? And in addition, if somebody's going to get infected, let's isolate them because usually you use isolation or quarantining sources to try to isolate the people most likely to get infected soon. But if you infect somebody on purpose, you know they've been infected soon. So let's create what I call variolation villages, or places where you go, you get infected with a small dose. Presumably that has, according to these previous reference points, a 3 to 30 times lower death rate from this infection. And they're isolated until they're recovered, and so they don't infect other people. And that allows us to spread out the death rate, the medical demand over time, so that not everybody's sick at the same time. It allows people to have this 3 to 30 lower death rate. It allows critical workers to sort of, you know, get certified early that they've recovered and then be safe to go into the work and to social contact. That's the generic idea here. And that's what I've been trying to get people to consider. And I think that's enough for my initial presentation, and we can go to Q&A.
Cool.
Discussion.
So for the people who just came in the chat, if you have a question for Robin, just write in the chat box. And then I'll call on you and unmute you, and you unmute yourself and just ask Robin the question. Or if you want me to read it on your behalf, just indicate that in the chat box. And I might not, we might not be able to get to every question. And I'm not going to ask them in order to. I'm going to use my discernment about what has the best sort of flow to it. And I'll warm up Robin with a few questions. And before like inquiring into the deliberate infection, I'm curious about bringing this to the personal. I've been talking to a lot of people about this situation, obviously, and it's like emotional roller coaster a lot of people are going through, wrestling with this radical uncertainty. So my question for you is, when did it dawn on you that this situation was going to be quite serious, and how have you been personally processing it?
I'm moving my cord here, which isn't plugging in, so I'm on battery power. I'm just checking there. But anyway, batteries should last for a while. I was tracking the news in February, and I think around February 12th, I looked at my records, and that's when I said to myself in a tweet to the public, I said, oh my goodness, this is not being kept in Wuhan. This is escaping Wuhan to other Chinese provinces in the rest of the world. And then in my simple-minded way, I said, it's gone. It's escaped the initial place. It'll go through the whole world. Oh my God. And that's when I was starting to be very concerned and tried to convince my wife to sell stocks, which I couldn't do. And my cord is bugging me there. And so 2 days later, I made my first post on this topic. I was trying to think about what could we do, and so since then, of course, you know, I was very concerned for a while. I tried to buy some stuff and tried to convince my wife and other people it was a problem. And of course, initially, everybody thought I was crazy because they hadn't heard this from anybody else. So of course, you know, there's no point in selling stocks before everybody else is going to sell stocks, right? Yes, there is. But anyway, and so, you know, but now I'm a professor, so I can still work from home, and we don't have children at home anymore. So, you know, it's relatively easy for us. You know, I'm not employed. I don't have sick family around, et cetera. Don't even have kids at home. But I feel for people who have a lot more problems here.
Right. And then the other question I had is kind of like how people's responses to all these different kind of ideas and suggestions right now. This is like provocative. Potentially productive for a lot of people if they hear this idea that you just presented. And even that tweet you sent out for the event, like we got a few retweets. Someone said, the internet was a mistake. They should do this event in person so you can practice what they preach, stuff like that. And I know you're no stranger to controversy via misunderstanding. So do you have any sense of how this type of stuff, just the suggestion of it, could be presented without creating that backlash against it?
I mean, we have to try. So to explore different ways of presenting it to different audiences, et cetera, there's no way to figure out ahead of time before you go start and try. So just jumping in and try.
Right. That's the Robin Hanson technique. Just jump in and go for it.
Yeah.
So
we tenured professors do have a little safer, I'll have to admit. So,
right.
If others of you feel a little shyer about being this bold, I can appreciate that. You may have employers who don't appreciate such things, for example.
Right. So let's turn to the Q&A. Jackson, you have a question? If you can unmute yourself and ask it to Robin.
Yeah, I'm curious. Hey, Robin, Jackson. Why has there been a difference in the impact between various viruses over the last 20 years? Obviously, the death rate and their virality, but is it, say, for example, SARS in the early 2000s didn't really escape much outside of Asia. Is it the nature of the virus? Is it the nature of the world?
So yeah, viruses just do vary a lot in their nature. There's they're complicated little things that can be very different. But the most important ones here are, say, for SARS, what percentage of people it kills. There's how fast it kills them. And then especially whether they show symptoms when they're infected all the time. So for SARS, as soon as people were infected, they showed symptoms. And so that makes it much easier to catch the infection. As soon as somebody has symptoms, you isolate them and check them and et cetera. But for this disease, you can be sick for a week without showing symptoms, which means you go lots of places and infect lots of other people before you show symptoms.
So the impact here is almost entirely due to the nature of the disease rather than the world being different than in
America. Right. I mean, we've had these sorts of diseases for centuries, of course. And our world has changed, but every 5 years or so we have another thing somewhat like this. But they vary in sort of how easy are their cares. So like AIDS, right? HIV, thanks, contrary to fears, that doesn't be patched by handshaking or coughing or, touching doorknobs, et cetera. You have to be pretty close to someone physically to catch AIDS, right? HIV. So this disease is relatively easy to pass on in the air, which is pretty severe. So, because that means we're around each other a lot and we breathe around each other a lot. And that's why masks might be a good idea. They differ in how they're caught, how easy they're to catch, whether you show symptoms when you're initially sick, how fast you go severe, and then what the chance of dying is. There's just a huge range of these things.
Cool. There's a lot of questions coming in. Narayan, you had a few questions.
I'm curious about how much you're coordinating with others with this idea, either to satisfactorily rule it out as a good idea or promote it as a viable strategy to the world.
My part of the world may be just less organized than you hope. I'm really just one person. And so I look at the world and I figure out things that seem to make sense. And then I try to talk to the world and react to the world and have them talk to me. So I'm a 60-year-old economist. I've had a long experience with having ideas that seem to make sense and try to convince the world mostly goes yawn, ignore. Often I never know whether it was a good idea because it's hard to get other people to engage it. I am puzzled here about why the usual experts aren't already all over this. They already know about the dose dependence of viruses. They already know about the history of smallpox. Why is it that I'm the one talking about this? That's just puzzling to me. But I do also know that often in many areas, there's just people get stuck in the way they think, and an outsider can sometimes see things that people don't see on the inside. But of course, usually an outsider who thinks they see something on the inside is wrong, because the insiders do know things. But partly then you need a conversation where the insiders explain, this is why you're wrong. Sorry, they've got, I don't know if you can hear sirens in my background here.
Yeah, no worries. I just want to reveal that I'm asking because I'm part of a coordination effort that involves a bunch of people in the medical community. And I was thinking from my side, is there a way in which I can actually take some of these ideas and help coordinate this? And how do I share this with this community?
I have a blog post I put up last night. And at the end, it lists a bunch of things you could do if you were wanting to help and different kinds of areas. So one of the things is just better medical literature research. If you have medical expertise, and there's a bunch of things there that you could do. But basically, I'm just trying to get other people to pay attention. I presume that if other people started to do more in this, I would suddenly be a small part of this in the background, because people will be, I'm just one person, and a lot more people will be doing other things. But at the moment, so I've looked out there and I found five other people in the last month who maybe voiced similar ideas and, you know, poached them somewhere, and, you know, pursuing it with some mild degree, but that's obviously not enough.
Okay. Rocco, you just had a question.
Yeah. Hi, Robin. I mean, basically my question is just going over what you've already said. Sure. You know, anything that you could do with deliberate infection, it seems to me is quite likely you could do better with a vaccine. And do you think people have done a cost-benefit analysis on the cost of letting people die versus the cost of a vaccine that has some risks associated with it versus the cost of lockdown? Because I did that calculation just now, and it seems to me that if, say, 500,000 people die, then the cost of the lockdown for, say, 6 months would be substantially bigger than the cost of those lives if you value them at, say, 5 million each. And the cost, presumably, of a vaccine that's imperfect would be even lower than the cost in lives.
So regarding a vaccine, the usual conventional business, which I buy, is that this is going to take at least 18 months, perhaps several years, and perhaps never.
But it takes that long because of the testing.
Yes, but of course, you don't want to use one without testing it, because most of them don't work, and some of them hurt. So yes, we don't want to be using a vaccine until it's tested. Now, there is the claim, which I find plausible, that we should be less shy about how we test. So typically, we either test on some other virus that's like it but not as deadly in this case, or we test on a whole population of people and then wait to see which of them get infected and then see how that helps them, rather than the more direct way of testing it, which is infect some people right after you gave them the vaccine and see if the vaccine protected them. Now, apparently they're not doing that yet, and that would be faster, but of course those people would take more of a risk, but it certainly seems cost-effective to me. Nobody doubts the cost-effectiveness of that, or that people would volunteer. They just think there's an ethical issue with letting people volunteer to help save millions of lives, which seems crazy to me, but there you are. But even with faster testing, basically there are many dozens of vaccine proposals out there. Most likely, most of them don't work. So vaccine searching isn't just a you do it and it's done. You have to search in a space of variations. Basically, you're taking the live virus and you're changing it in a bunch of ways so that it's not deadly, but that maybe your body would latch on to the same thing. But searching a lot of things to fight that. So that's
yeah, I mean,
is it coming?
I did actually see some, sorry to interrupt. I did see some people who were looking at synthetic RNA vaccines where you actually don't need to use live vaccine, but that's another debate. So, I mean, I guess my question was just in the space of all possible trade-offs, you know, is variolation or deliberate exposure really optimal? Should we maybe just try to persuade the vaccine people to do their thing much more aggressively and just
they still say that even if you do it more aggressively, you're talking, you know, at least 6 months here. So in the next month, 6 months, it seems likely that maybe everybody would already be infected, you see, by the time the vaccine comes out.
Okay.
You know, this is doubling. It was doubling initially every week, and now in some places it seems to be doubling every few, you know, 3 days. At that rate, you don't have 6 months. You talk about trade-offs. The other trade-off is between how hard to try to suppress, how hard to clamp down in order to prevent growth and even suppress the virus. And as you know, a lot of places have gone harder on suppression in the last 2 weeks, but apparently not enough. That is, even now, on average, most places are still allowing the virus to grow, not shrink, but just at a slower rate. Now, as long as we're doing that, that gives us more time to try to set up variolation. If say, this peaked in within 3 weeks, and in 3 weeks the entire world got it, then maybe I couldn't do anything in 3 weeks, right? It would be too fast. But if we're going to try really hard to suppress and we fail, we might take a couple months to fail. And then maybe, you know, that'll give us a chance to do something like this. So, you know, in general, spreading it out over time again gives us each a chance to to have a bigger slice of the medical system devoted to us, which is good. On the other hand, isolating people means they are more likely to get a high dose, which is bad. So it's not clear whether that's a good trade-off.
Okay. Let's go to Caitlin Grimes. You had a question?
Yes. I was wondering, like, how do we choose who gets infected? So if the death rate is high for elderly people and people with underlying conditions, then do we infect them? Like, would it be ethical to do that? Or do we only infect people who are at a low risk and then keep the two groups separated?
So in the last week, I realized there was this dose effect that was really powerful. I've been focused on that. But in the previous weeks, I had just been focused on the benefits of deliberate infection, even without this dose effect, where I calculated there was at least a 20% reduction in deaths just using that and a 20% for another effect. So in that analysis, what I found that the optimal thing to do was, there's two things you can do. You can have isolation where you just isolate people, but you don't infect them, of course. Now they're more protected. And then you could also deliberately infect people, deliberately expose them. So in my analysis, it was better to take the young and healthy and deliberately expose them and isolate the old and sick. And that cut deaths 40% below randomly doing no deliberate infection and just random isolation. So 40% I thought was a lot. Okay. But of course, now we're talking a factor of 3 to 30, which is far more bigger. But even then, I was thinking of volunteers, not forcing people. So, I was thinking you make a place where people could go get infected, but they would volunteer for it. Now, if we thought it was a good policy, maybe we'd all want to subsidize that and encourage it, sort of cover the expenses, maybe add a bonus. Maybe we'd want to do that more for critical care workers, like medical workers, people who work with electrical systems, things like that. But the idea was just to take volunteers rather than force people.
Sorry. Did you take into account people who would accidentally get infected anyway and still be transmitting it within the community?
Well, I mean, that's what's already happening. So my analysis was including that usual effect, of course, and it was adding this other effect of assuming there's a rate at which people are infecting each other accidentally, and now we add a place where people can go in quarantine where they have a smaller degree of infecting each other because they're more protected. And then we use part of that quarantine space to deliberately infect people and then keep them isolated there till they're recovered. And that's the analysis that produced, 40% reduction in death rates.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Siddharth, you had a few questions.
Hi, Robin. Had a couple of questions. So first, I just wanted to start with, let's say we consider healthcare workers, and for them, this might be the most bang for the buck because they're the ones highest risk of receiving high doses of the virus. Then it seems that strategies which provide sufficient personal protection to the healthcare workers are successful in Taiwan and Korea and Singapore. So I suspect that one counter argument to this proposal would be that we don't need to do this risky thing. We already have a solution to protect these people. We just need to do it properly, which we aren't currently doing it. So I was curious about what you thought about that.
Well, so I'm not clear about whether you're just talking protecting the healthcare workers themselves or the entire society. So if an entire society becomes infected, the healthcare workers are eventually going to be infected too.
Sure.
They can't protect themselves from that. So you might be talking about, but you could say Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea have already so far seemed to have successfully repressed this. Why can't we do that too?
No, that's not what I was asking, because I know that they started early and they started test and trace early. So I know that that strategy is too late for many countries.
Right.
Or at the very least, it's not possible.
So even assuming we could temporarily protect our healthcare workers with some method, still we have the question of what about the rest of us?
Right.
If we're all going to get it soon and we're all going to get it accidentally, we're going to suffer, the usual accidental death rate from this. could we do better?
Sure. Yeah, that's fair. I just thought that the case was strongest to that case. Another question, is it okay, Peter, if I jump onto another question? Okay. So I asked this on Twitter, but I'll just ask it again in case you have some new thinking on this, which was that why hasn't this been done for viruses other than smallpox? And one thought that I had, and I'm curious what you think about it, is that it's just really hard to isolate. It was really hard to isolate viral samples for anything other than smallpox, because smallpox had the quote unquote benefit that there were scabs on your skin that you could pick up and grind and sort of store in a way that transports and keeps for a long period of time. So, but for polio, it's not clear what you would keep. So I guess, do you think that that's possible? Do you think that now we can cultivate viral samples in the lab from, you know, from infected people? So perhaps that objection doesn't really work.
So, I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this area, but my understanding is that over the last century, we've gotten used to the vaccine solution. Mm-hmm. And we think of that as the advanced solution, and this variolation thing is the old-fashioned thing that we used to do long before we knew how to do a better thing. Mm-hmm. And vaccines are fine for a disease that's been around for a while, because you know, the 2 years it takes to develop one is not a problem. Vaccines are only a problem for these very new things. And so far, we basically squashed all the new things relatively quickly. Through, you know, trace, except for things like influenza, where the death rate was really relatively low. And so, you know, we weren't, I guess they weren't thinking about it. I don't know. But I wish I knew why the current standard professionals aren't all over this already, why they aren't talking about it, why they don't have a reason. But I could imagine that just so far, they didn't have to go there, or they didn't feel pressured to go there, because their toolkit seemed to work. And that this does feel and look bad to people. That is, you know, infecting you with the actual virus, where you have an actual chance of dying, seems pretty old-fashioned and mean and, you know, crude, what they had to do in the old days. But we modern people shouldn't have to deal with that.
And one final question on this is that Roko brought up the question of, so let's say we remove barriers to testing on viruses and allow participants of clinical trials to take much higher risks than they currently do, then it seems possible that we might be able to get a reasonably effective, reasonably safe vaccine within 6 months. And I think 6 months might also be the time scale on which the variolation strategy would have to be tested and tried in small scale trials before society would be willing in any sort of way to accept it, because I just think,
Well, so it's a big world. We're talking the entire world is going to be infected by this soon. It's not just the United States. So given how big and varied the world is, I could certainly imagine some part of the world trying this with less solid pre-testing. So again, you know, we're talking about people who are going to get this anyway. And so do you want to try some way to get a smaller dose, even if it's not as solid a data set as you might get after a six-month big study? It's not crazy that somebody somewhere in the world will think that's worth a try. It's not obvious to me that you'd have to wait 6 months. And again, like, this is much simpler, right? We're just going to look at ways to do smaller doses, basically, but ways to have contact with, say, somebody who's sick in a smaller dose. There's just a lot of simple things to experiment. It's not that complicated. It's not like you have to do a lot of necessarily chemical things or whatever. Again, what I hear is that vaccines will take a while, even if we accelerate the testing. And also just, this is a plan B. I mean, I was trying to emphasize that at the beginning. Please pursue the vaccine. Yes, I don't mean to say not try for that, but let's set up a plan B. Let's at least be ready to do something else if vaccines don't come. And even if it doesn't turn out to be needed for this pandemic, you know what? This is not going to be the last pandemic. This is, in some sense, a dress rehearsal for something even bigger that will come down the line that will matter even more.
Right. So, Amy, you had a question?
Yeah, and my question is kind of related to the idea of the places where this is happening. I live in New York City, and I mean, even if my video is not working, but if I showed you what I can see right now, I mean, I don't think that this is going to work here. I think that for the most part, this is a indeliberate or non-deliberate infection that's going on here. So I'm wondering if a place like New York City that is so dense and so heavily populated, so many people getting infected, so many more people are very much likely to get infected, will that eventually become like a haven to do trials of this type of deliberate infection, since I think at some point it'll taper off just as it's getting hotter in other parts of this country and the world?
I'm not clear how the level of infection in an area really affects people's willingness to do trials about this sort of thing. There are several conflicting factors, and I don't see a clear answer. Now, it's clear that if there's almost no threat of a problem, then people aren't very motivated to deal with the problem. And as the threat gets larger, they get more motivated to deal with something, but then they also just get more scared and hunkered down and not being reflective or willing to take chances, and less able to coordinate. So it's not clear to me that when you're in the peak of this, that's the time people would be willing to do something organized together. They might be desperately willing to do something personally, but I'm less optimistic about individual random people trying to deliberately infect themselves. More optimistic about us organizing some way to do that together. By doing some trials and some collecting some data and public, telling each other what we tried. And then some. So in my post, I talk about how you might have a place, like take an old hotel that at the moment isn't being used, or a university campus, and bring people there all together, infect a whole cohort of people at the same time. Then they can be there together and socialize and interact. And you, with a large cohort, you could just try different variations and different ways to infect them, and different, apparently these antivirals that can slow the virus growth rate. And, with even just a few thousand people, you could do a lot of experimentation and find out what worked best. But just individuals who are scared, hunkering down in New York, finally deciding they want to do this on tomorrow because they're scared, I mean, that might help, but I mean, they're taking big chances and it's going to be harder to collect data out of that, so the rest of us could learn from it. Mm-hmm.
Jake, you had a question?
Yeah, thanks, Robin. So my question is just about how high a percentage of compliance you would need, given that you're talking about volunteers, in order for it to be effective at the kind of scale that you want it to. And do you think that the suspicion that you would have low compliance, in addition to the fact that the optics of kind of coercing people into doing this would be very bad, given that some small percentage of people are going to die. Do you think that that's why it's not being considered more broadly, that people just don't assume that people be willing to infect themselves when they have a kind of last-ditch idea in their mind that they wouldn't accidentally get infected, that they could comply with social distancing measures and things like that?
So, I'm an economist, and we economists very much distinguish things that you do that benefit you personally from things that we could do together that benefits us collectively, even if some of us suffer personally. And obviously, social distancing and other sort of policies are presented and are in many ways social policies, that if enough of us do it together, we could together get benefits. And so if any one person deviates by, say, not social distancing, then the rest of us feel like we should socially shame them and discourage them in order to get the collective to do what we all need. This is not a social collective policy. This is something that you can personally benefit from, plausibly. That is, if there is, in fact, a factor of 3 to 30 reduction in your death rate because you get deliberately infected, voluntarily infected, then that's something you might want to do for your own personal benefit. We don't have to push you into that. And then there's no minimum threshold for being effective. The more people that do it, the better. So it can just be a thing that we put out there. The main thing that we need to collectively do is to allow it, to give permission. So we are so focused on collectively preventing people from hurting us all that we've set up a system that actually makes it hard to just do this now, or at least it seems hard. So one of the first priorities here would just be to find a way to get legal permission, so that you could just try to experiment with this voluntary infection and work, then you don't need the world to agree with you. You don't need the world to go along. You don't need some percentage of people to do it. You just do it and you get the benefit.
and the persuasive frame there is you can control the amount of your dose, which you'd never be able to control in an accidental context, and therefore vastly lower your risk of death.
Right, so you show up to this, what I call variolation village, and you know, maybe there's a cohort of 1,000 people who all show up at this, you know, say it's a university dorms or something. You all show up at the same time. We're all immediately isolated and immediately infected. And you know that that's when it's happening. And then as soon as you're all, you know, verified to be infected, you know, either individually or statistically based on previous experience, now you can go interact with each other. And then some of you will get sick, but we'll all be watching out for that. And once you get sick, we will take to immediate medical care that's available right there. And then as soon as, you know, you are completely recovered from this, then you can, that's when you can leave this place. And it might be a staggered process over a week or two when different people left. But, you know, it would have all happened in this controlled context. And the rest of us can be assured that you're not infecting the rest of us. If you're just infecting yourself but not isolating yourself, then the rest of us should be much more concerned about that and much more reluctant to let you do that, because then you're just speeding up the whole pandemic when we were all trying to slow it down.
Thanks.
Okay, Brian, you had a question.
Hi, Robin. I would like to hear your predictions for the number of total cases and deaths by the end of 2020. Also, your prediction for when quarantines will be lifted, and also how bad you think the economy will get.
So back in mid-February, when I said, oh my God, this is going to go everywhere, and other people thought that was kind of silly, I made a bunch of bets right then. So I think I made like 11 bets about the following. Would the world have more than 10 million deaths by 2022? That is the end of the coming year. And I got 11 people to give me 10 to 1 odds that that was not going to happen. But I still think that's, you know, in the ballpark of something plausible to happen. I also made some bets about whether 250,000 people in the US would die by that same time. And, you know, the current newspaper today or yesterday said, you know, it would be a good outcome if only 100,000 people died. I think that means they're admitting that it's not crazy for 250,000 people to die in the US. So the economic effect is a choice we have. So, you know, that's a choice about our policy response. I'm pretty clear that the economic costs are high. Lockdown is expensive. We are a rich world and we can, in some sense, afford to pay a lot for things, but it will be expensive. And the key question is, are we paying the right amount for the right thing? In some sense, the worst case is we pay an enormous amount and we still don't keep it from spreading. And then we are hit with the same massive death wave that we would have been hit with anyway. And that we don't do much about it through variolation or other means. And we just still have a peak where within the same roughly month, most of the people in an area get sick. And then mostly they don't have much of medical care to help them. And we will either just hit that in the next few weeks because our methods are just not helping, or our methods will be helping, in which case they will slow it down and we will hit a peak in the next few months. Or if we're lucky, we will suppress it in the next few weeks or months so that it can get smaller, but it'll never go down to zero. And then we're faced with repeatedly having to suppress it when it pops back up again and doing that indefinitely until a vaccine shows up. And that could also fail, in which case, you know, we could even suppress it for 6 months at great expense, and then it still pops up and takes over. We still have all the same deaths.
Okay. Noam, you had a question.
Might some countries be more politically and legally amenable than the United States or Canada or most Western countries to a variolation village experiment? And under what circumstances might the data gathered there be useful to us?
I'm sure the data would be very useful. That is, this disease isn't very different for different people in the world. At least that's the current thinking. There has been substantial variation around the world, and people are puzzling over that. And I think dose effects are one plausible contribution to those big variations. But I think an experiment most anywhere would be informative. And of course, the main things would just be you find out, well, what, how do you deliver a small dose? And then what's the death rate associated with that? And then there's some other questions like, do you take it in your mouth? Do you take it, you breathe it? Do you do it on the skin? What will be the way to deliver it? And then there's, like I said, antivirals that might in conjunction also help. And so just whatever data they have on what people tried and what the death rates were would be great wherever they did it. Obviously, there are many places with a lot of varying regulations. And if it weren't for the fact that it started in China, I might have said China and the East would have been more open to this. But of course, partly what's going on is, say, China and South Korea and Singapore, their story now is, well, we've kept it out. We don't need anything else. We're done. The rest of the world should copy us. And until they face the threat that this will, in fact, sweep back onto them, that they can't, and they can't keep it out, they probably wouldn't be interested in variation until they actually felt threatened, which unfortunately they probably eventually will be. But then waiting for them to do that at that late date may be kind of late.
Perhaps a country like Turkey or some semi-authoritarian place. I have no idea.
It's a random thing, right? The world is.
Robin, are you there? It looks like your camera froze.
And Turkey will say, well, why don't we try that here?
Your camera froze there, Robin. We missed the last 30 seconds of that.
Oh. Sorry, I need to get a better internet.
Well, you're anyway. Back. You're back now. You're good.
Good.
Okay.
Making me realize how I need to change things here.
Yeah. Okay. So we got a question. Dan Feldman, you have a question?
Yeah, I had a few, but I'll just try to pick one of them here. Well, what is your view on herd immunity, and how does it influence either plan A, the vaccine, or plan B, the microdosages with isolation?
So herd immunity is what happens when most of us get infected. And it's the thing that naturally stops the whole process after that point. If we're trying to suppress, i.e. prevent most people from getting infected, then herd immunity isn't what we're going for. We're going for suppression. And many people are hopeful about that, and that's the official focus a lot of policy, is the claim that we're going to suppress. I'm skeptical that we're going to succeed, but I'm happy to let us try, at least at a modest cost. But unless we suppress, herd immunity is basically what we're going for in the long run. It's basically most people, enough people get it so that there's not enough people to infect more people. It's just the name for the scenario where most people get it, so the disease can't really grow.
Peter, can I ask one follow-up question?
Yep.
Your solution, if I'm getting this correct, it appears to be sort of a playing on perhaps libertarian or a neoclassical sensibilities, playing on self-interest, that if I go to a place and get a microdose and get infected, then this protects me personally, but it also has this benefit, and I'm not quite exactly sure of the argument yet, that this also benefits the collective. And I'm just wondering, am I understanding this correctly? And if I am understanding this correctly, do you see this as, you know, given that we're still operating in kind of a libertarian, neoliberal, neoclassical world, that this gives your idea a certain advantage, a stickiness that could take hold in the culture?
I mean, I have a PhD in formal political theory. I, of course, know a lot of things about politics and coordination and governance, but I don't really think this issue, is affected much by that stuff. Just in general, in the world, sometimes, we have problems where each person can help themselves and that adds up to a fix for everybody. And sometimes we have coordination problems, which that doesn't work for, where we need to work together to suppress individual incentives so that we can produce a collective outcome. Coordination is hard. So there are many coordination problems in the world that we fail to coordinate to achieve. Global warming, war, innovation, fisheries, et cetera. And in many ways, people think of pandemics as having big coordination problems, especially if they're trying to do suppression via social distancing, et cetera. But this particular solution happens not to need coordination, which is good, because coordination is hard to achieve. That's not a statement about libertarian policy or anything else. It's just the fact of the world. Often the debates of governance is about whether our governance systems are good enough to achieve certain kinds of coordination or not. So some people might say, look, at the world level, we just can't achieve global warming policy. The world is an anarchy. The world does not coordinate. Sorry, we're just not going to do anything. And other people might say, no, we need to try harder and pay more costs to stronger institutions that can help us coordinate. That's a standard debate. And, at other points, happy to engage that and participate, but that's not the issue here. Here, the issue is we've set up regulatory systems to prevent people from hurting themselves with medicine, but that's getting in the way of this way people could just help themselves. If only we allowed it.
Okay, so we'll have maybe two more questions. Raven, you have a question for Robin?
Yeah, hi, we both have a question. Hi, Robin. Thanks for being here. Yeah, so let's say that this proposal would work. How do you think that people's intuitive or perceived risk when thinking about this proposal, their cognitive biases would play out in their reactions? So both experts, but then also the general public. Perceived level of risk and also versus a person's perceived level of autonomy over avoiding illness right now?
I'm not sure risk and autonomy are the dominant effects. I mean, I see that they are effects, but I'm not sure they're the strongest one. I would say that the biggest one is just a sort of conformity and authoritarianism that people have with respect to medicine. That is, until the medical authorities recommend something, they don't think anybody should do it. Mm-hmm. And that's here. And of course, until other people are doing it, the medical authorities are recommending it. Many individual people don't want to do something, especially regarding medical treatments or diseases or something. So it's long been observed, and it is true, and you're seeing it now, that people who are very independent and autonomous in times of peace and prosperity, when there is a big threat, like a war or a pandemic, they suddenly become much more conservative. They suddenly want to give government more power. They suddenly want the collective to have more power. They want to repress dissent, repress deviation. Because they're scared and they think we need to all stick together with a common policy to make things work. And that's what we're seeing now. But unfortunately, if the authorities endorse this and if everybody else was doing it, I think most people go along just fine. That's certainly what we saw in the 1700s. So in the 1700s, initially, a lot of people thought variolation was crazy and they were highly opposed to it. It's like the anti-vaxxers today at the old Icky. But once the authorities were behind it, most people were doing it, then most people did it. And it was a standard thing to do. And that's just more the dominant factor here is about conformity and authority and less about your personal calculation of risk, unfortunately. Mm. Obviously it's how you frame it, right? You could think, I'm gonna go in this place and I might die. Sure, but of course I'm gonna stay out here and I might die. And so if you're thinking about the difference between not going in and going in, that's a different framing than thinking about the absolute risk you take by going in. And of course, we have this framing about what risk we let other people take. And so even today, as Other would mention, people have proposed accelerated vaccine trials where people are paid in order to get the actual virus and then a vaccine. And a lot of people oppose that. That's an ethical issue for a lot of people, even at the moment. And so this would bring up those similar sort of ethical issues. Right. Do we allow people to voluntarily go in, even if they might get a lower dose?
Okay. Last question. Let's go with Daniel Zev.
Hey, Robin, big fan. My question is, are you yourself going to get deliberately infected? And if not, what would it take for you to do that?
Somehow this has muted me? No, okay. This told me I was muted today. For a moment. Okay, never mind. There's two issues. One, do I want to do something illegal or do I want to stay within the legal framework and try to make something legal that we can do above board, right? And another issue is, do I want to do some individual personal action with my own little personal resources, or do I want to be part of some group or organization that does things together? So here, my main initial strategy has been to try to do things legally together. So if we could set up a thing where many people together were being deliberately infected, I certainly am open to being part of that process. I'm not going to just go try to do it myself personally by flying to China or something. That doesn't make much sense. The point is to, first of all, you know, do it enough together that we can collect data together about what works or not. And I'm, you know, willing to consider being part of a trial. But then, of course, you know, we'd want to do a trial with the people who are the most apt and appropriate for it and collect the data. And you'd like some medical professionals to be part of this process to set up how it happens and set up how it's traced. And, you know, I mostly now want to try to help us together do this. So I'm less focused on me saving myself and more how could we together create a process where we can do this together. I would hold out the possibility that if we kept having legal impermission and opposition, or at least ambiguity, maybe some sort of civil disobedience or group where it does it anyway in defiance of perhaps rules. But even then, I'd want to do it with other people together where we had organized it and we're trying to do it systematically, sharing information about how to do it, that sort of thing.
All right. Very cool. Raven had a slogan. Do you want to end it off? No, she says legally together. Great slogan. Okay. We'll end it there. Robin, I'll give it to
you. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah. Thank you everyone for coming. Thank you, Robin. Do you have any closing thoughts before I do some closing announcements?
Not myself. No, you're all, you know, great and paying attention, taking seriously that I can't ask anymore.
Great. So I'll make some closing announcements in a moment. And Robin, again, thank you so much for coming today. Thank you everyone for the great questions. We have a lot of cool events coming up at the STOA. We have some meditations, breath work, even existential dance parties. Robin, I'd love for you to come to the next existential dance party. I think that would be quite a treat for you.
I'm not sure how that works, but okay.
Yeah, it's quite fun. And then the session we have tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern time is a Stoic training program. So you can RSVP that on the website, and that's www.thestoa.ca. And the STOA is running off a gift economy. I'm viewing this as a gift to the world in this time of need. If you're inspired to provide a gift in return, just go to the website and the gift economy, and there's more information there. All right, everyone. Thank you again.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks Peter.
Thanks, Robin.